Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge Munsee community. I'm Lennox Aputo.
And I'm Bria Barthel. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, first, Mark Dunley reports on local climate strikes for March 19th's Fridays for Future. Then our Water Justice Lab fellows explore issues of lead in water. After that, Hugh Johnson joins us to discuss Earth Day, predictions for wildfires this summer, and of course, the weather forecast for the week. Later on, we hear from Carol Roberts about upcoming activities for tots through teens at the Troy Public Library. And then we end with Willie Terry's conversation with Reverend Ibrahim Pedranan, president of the Albany County Federation of Labor. But first, a few headlines.
The Times Union reports that Schenectady has the highest rate of chronically absent students in the capital region. Out of 3,510 students who skipped at least a month of school without an excuse, 20% of them were not up to date on their vaccinations. Schenectady saw a 67% increase in absenteeism from 2018 to 2023.
A California company is planning to build a large battery storage facility at the site of an auto scrapyard in Catskill. Such large arrays of giant batteries are designed to provide backup electricity for times when there is a gap in the power grid.
The Times Union reports that the Papskanee Island Historic District, with its 21 archaeological sites and cultural significance to the Stockbridge Munsee Band of Mohican Indians, could be removed from the State Register of Historic Places if a lawsuit filed by the Sunoco Company is successful. The oil company wants its 38-acre fuel terminal site at 100 American Oil Road, built in the 1930s, removed by the Papskanee Island Historic District.
Troy Mayor Carmen Mantello is issuing a request for proposal for someone to renovate existing space to serve as a new Troy City Hall. Among the locations being looked at are the Headley Park Place and the former Price Chopper in Lansingburg. And that's it for the headlines.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, listener-supported radio that builds community in Troy and the surrounding capital region through broad grassroots participation.
Our content is produced by volunteers. To learn how you can join our team or contribute your financial support, see the donate button at mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call us 518-272-2390. We welcome your suggestions for segment topics, too.
Now to our first story. April 22nd is Earth Day, an annual day to demonstrate support for environmental protection. On April 19th, the Capital Region joined the Global Day of Action with Fridays for the Future by rallying at the state capital in Albany and calling for NYS Comptroller Tom Napoli to divest from fossil fuels in Israel. Mark Dunley brings us this coverage from the rally.
Friday, April 19th, was a global day of climate strikes called for by Fridays for Future. In the United States, a key focus was to urge President Biden to declare a climate emergency. A rally was held at the state capitol in Albany with a call for New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli to divest both from fossil fuels and Israel. The rally highlighted the need to better connect the climate and peace movements. We hear from local Friday for Future organizers, Zahn Plymill and Ryan, followed by local peace and justice advocate, Eleanor Stein, and Matt Oil of Extinction Rebellion.
It is kind of rare for an environmentally focused group. Fridays for Future is a climate justice organization with emphasis on to be hosting an event that specifically discusses the issue of Palestine and Israel and divestment from Israel. So I want to give you a little bit of background on the Comptroller's Office, because So the comptroller's office just handles financial responsibilities. Thomas DiNapoli manages the New York State Common Retirement Fund, which is one of the largest funds, one of the largest pension funds in the world, and I think the third largest in the nation. It's $250 billion with a B. The main call for this event is to ask Comptroller DiNapoli to follow through with his commitments to divest from fossil fuels and to make additional commitments to divest from Israeli bonds. Fuel divestment has been, in my knowledge, 12 years in the making at least. And the call for divestment from Israeli bonds has been one newly renewed. And I feel like they go together like bread and butter. I'm hoping that peace organizations and environmental organizations can come together, start working together a bit more. I'm going to try out a little chant with you guys that I heard at the SUNY divestment rally on Monday. And it goes, "We want justice. You say how. We demand divestment now." Because as it stands currently, there's no retirement on a dead planet. And the way the retirement system is currently set up, it is retirement for thee and not retirement for me.
There is no excuse for the destruction of Mother Earth in the name of profit. Many of the fossil fuel companies have known about the extent of their destruction since the 70s. Some companies even knew as early as 1954 about the extent of the damage of Mother Earth. Extraction of resources from Mother Earth for profit is never ethical and always has consequences on the natural environment, and always we need a system that prioritizes people and the planet, not wealth. It is the youth generation's job to fight towards liberation of Mother Earth from the current profit-oriented system. Climate justice cannot be achieved without social justice and the end of all forms of oppression. The climate crisis is only a small part of a much bigger inequality crisis that dates back to the early colonizers, with the belief that people should be treated differently based on the socially constructed concept of race, and that it's okay to exploit them and their lands as resources for profit. As youth, we must recognize these social inequalities and add them into the climate justice movement too. We must not leave out social inequalities of the climate justice movement. A majority of major polluting facilities are near communities of where Black, Indigenous, and people of color live. The least responsible for the climate crisis are the most affected. The people who caused the climate crisis, primarily fossil fuel executives, have the luxury to live comfortably, while the people they exploit and the least responsible have to live the consequences. Join the climate justice movement now. Working in the fight towards climate justice can come in many different forms, from organizing actions like this here to organizing for waste removal and ecological restoration in mass numbers, to connecting with activists globally and organizing with them. We must fight together for a very fast transition and just transition away from the use of fossil fuels towards clean sources of energy. We must not prioritize profit and economic growth and start prioritizing people on the planet completely. We must work to fix the damage that has been done to the natural environment and mass reforestation.
We are unstoppable. Another world is possible. Weeks after the invasion of the Gaza Strip, Israel awarded six different gas exploration licenses to companies like British Petroleum for, again, natural gas exploration off of the Gaza Marine. We don't really have the legal right to do that, and if we want to save this planet, maybe we shouldn't be, you know, exploiting a trillion cubic pounds of natural gas. But the last thing I want to share is the water quality in Gaza has been a hot topic for Human Rights Watch organizations for a while now. This is also intentional. This is due to the destruction and damaging of water and sewage treatment plants, and then, of course, refusing necessary repair items into the Gaza Strip. So as of right now, 97% of the water in Gaza is undrinkable. I think we call that ecocide, because I think that applies to really every living thing in that area. I want to hand it off to Eleanor Steen, who wrote alongside her partner Jeff Jones an article in The Nation talking about the need for a ceasefire and how that ties into the climate.
And I want to call out from all of us a solidarity with the students of Columbia who've been, over 100 have been arrested, where if they had allowed and encouraged an open discussion of Palestine and Israel, I think none of this would have happened. But this is the fruit of the university just trying to not only expel students, but expel ideas. The second thing I want to say is that I've been studying what I call war and warming. And we are in a critical moment in the fight against climate change, where the changes that should be made by our government and other governments in the next 5 to 10 years are critical to reversing some of the worst impacts of climate change and preventing some of the worst accumulation of warming gases in the atmosphere. And yet, at this moment, where global cooperation is the most important thing needed to address climate change, global cooperation is impossible because of the war in Gaza and because of the actions of the United States government, which is now a rogue state in violation of the International Court of Justice and international laws, and is funding and arming Israel and participating and supporting and embracing a genocidal war. That is preventing meaningful negotiations on climate change. We cannot solve warming unless we can end war. And that means that our peace movements, our anti-war movements, and our climate and environmental movements need to come together at this critical moment to look at these things together. The final thing I'll point out, Comptroller always says his sole responsibility is to look at for the fiscal health of the pension fund. However, we're now looking at a situation where investment in Israel is not a good investment. Israel is going to be held responsible by the world community for reparations and restoration of the tremendous death and damage that it has created in Palestine, both in Gaza and in the West Bank.
My name is Matt Oyle. I'm a member of Extinction Rebellion and Socialist Alternative. Extinction Rebellion's first ever action here in the capital region was an occupation of the comptroller's office, pushing for the divestment of fossil fuels, which he committed to later that year, but as of course backed up on. I really wish I could say that DiNapoli was the sole antagonist here, or that he was simply ignorant or didn't care. But he is in fact one player in a system that actively benefits from oppression and environmental destruction. That system being capitalism. Capitalist system not only thrives on, but also rely on exploitation around the world. While thousands upon thousands are slaughtered in Gaza, weapon contractors like Raytheon are raking in profits. I'll just add that even if all fossil fuel emissions were to stop tomorrow, we'd still be headed towards environmental disaster due to the imperialist violence happening not only in Palestine, but also in Sudan, Ukraine, Congo, and so many other places. And it's only on a trajectory to get even worse with escalating tensions between Israel and Iran, threatening to turn this into a regional war, as well as further escalation of competition and tensions in the new Cold War between the U.S. and China. And working people will be the ones who bear the brunt, not only through slaughter in the trenches, but with military spending coming at the expense of funding for healthcare, housing, education, etc. If we truly hope to see an end to this brutal system and an end to the climate crisis and an end to the genocide in Palestine, we must break with the capitalist parties like the Democratic Party and build our own political forces. Woo-hoo! But by rebuilding a militant labor movement and organizing strikes and walkouts in our workplaces and schools, again like we're seeing in Colombia right now, and by building international working class solidarity with all oppressed peoples around the world.
This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Wishing everyone a wonderful Earth Day, and we'll hear more about that in our segment with you coming up. So let us know how you honor Earth Day by commenting on Media Sanctuary's Facebook or Instagram post. And thanks to Mark Dunley for bringing so much attention to local climate movements throughout the year.
This past weekend, there was canvassing in North Central Troy and Lansingburg to educate neighbors on the lead pipes in Troy, an ongoing issue for Troy's residents. Jonna Babru, a local mother, became vocal about change in Troy after she discovered lead in her drinking water. Last summer, she spoke with Water Justice Lab fellows about this experience.
Water Justice Lab here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media's Nature Lab spent summer 2023 investigating water quality and water infrastructure in Troy and the Capital Region. They learned about and reported on contaminants like sewage and waterways and microplastics and lead in drinking water. On August 2nd, the team met with advocates and activists working on the lead pipe issue in Troy and visited the Rensselaer County Drinking Water Treatment Plant together to see how local water gets cleaned, processed, and piped out to our homes. Jonna Favreau, a local parent and safe drinking water advocate, joined the team to talk about her experiences with lead contamination in her family's drinking water. She was interviewed by fellow Musa Milmote.
My name is Jonna Favreau. I'm a mother and a resident here in Troy, New York.
Can you tell us what the situation is that led up to you getting involved with Water Justice?
Back in 2022, my son was initially tested for lead in his blood, and it came back elevated. That's when I did some digging and realized that the city of Troy had received over $500,000 in grant funding to replace lead pipes. I started reaching out to neighbors and community members to see if they too were experiencing the same issues of having lead in blood of their children, and that's how we got here today.
Why do you think Troy hasn't put money towards the lead pipe situation in the past?
That's a great question. Politics in Troy, I'm very new to, and I know there are a lot of moving pieces to keep a city going. I don't know why this money went unspent, and I don't know why it wasn't a priority, but I'm optimistic that in the future, this is going to be a priority for the city of Troy. I wish they spent the money and started 6 years ago.
Personally, at my house, the water doesn't feel safe to drink, so we buy bottled cases of water. So how do you think the city can make people feel safe to drink their tap water?
I think the first action that the city of Troy should take is to provide water filters to all residents whose lines have been tested and that they're positive for lead, either in the water or lead pipes in the house. And I think they should continue to provide those water filters until the lead pipes are removed from their homes. The city's estimating that it's going to take 10 to 15 years to replace all these pipes, and that's a long time to continue to poison the residents, because that's what's happening. There is no safe level of lead in our drinking water, so they should be removing it as soon as possible, and that's through water filters. And I think that would make residents like yourself and myself feel safe every single day.
For people's information, what happens to kids who are exposed to the lead?
There's a number of different symptoms. There are delays in milestones. There's weight loss or suppressed diet. That's something that both of those were in our household. That was an indicator for us of why we needed to test for lead. Neurologically, it impacts a child. And then, from what I've understood, upset stomachs, things like that. I thankfully have not felt any of these symptoms, but in children, they're developing. It's stored in their bones. That's why it's very important to have them tested early and often.
Thank you. Your activism has helped spread awareness. How have you done that? What techniques have you used?
I feel like I got really lucky knowing one person who knew somebody who knew somebody. But my biggest point of advice would be to just keep talking, no matter how shaky your voice is. I'm somebody who gets very nervous talking in public, but I was never silenced, no matter how unheard I felt or how nervous I was. And I kept speaking up until somebody heard me and until enough people realized that what I had to say was worth taking action on.
Since Troy is working on the lead pipes and is going to take a long time, after the pipes are fixed, do you think problems with drinking water will come up again?
I hope not. Water is a new topic for me this year. I know there are a lot of issues with different possible contaminants. I'm hopeful that the city will act quickly and swiftly to remove all lead from the water. But I hope this incident also teaches them to be proactive instead of reactive. So hopefully they'll start working with community members like the Nature Lab to continue to provide clean drinking water for all residents.
Thank you for being with us today and sharing your story. This has been Musa Mahmoud with Jana Favreau for Water Justice Lab.
After Musamo's conversation with Jana, the team headed to the drinking water treatment plant together, where they learned a lot about how lead gets into the water from a knowledgeable treatment plant employee. Ellie Irons, a Nature Lab community science educator and lab manager, who was there on the trip, spoke with me, Emily Schussis, to share some of what they learned. The water utility tests water for contaminants and water quality, starting at the Tomhannock Reservoir all the way through to when it leaves the plant, so they have some idea as to where lead seeps into our water supply. What was learned from these tests?
Hi, Emily. Yeah, we learned a lot on the trip to the treatment plant. The treatment staff do all sorts of testing for all kinds of contaminants that could harm our drinking water supply. And from this testing, they know there's no lead in the reservoir and there's no lead introduced in the transmission system where they move all the water inside the plant. As it leaves the plant, the water goes into a water main. This is the big pipe that takes water out of the treatment plant and moves it towards Troy. And this pipe's made of cast iron or ductile iron, which is lead-free. So there's no lead being introduced to drinking water at this point, which leads them to determine that lead contamination of our drinking water coming out of taps and buildings in Troy is happening in three places. One of them we've heard a lot about. The pipe that comes off the water main and goes into the house can be made of lead if it was installed before or around 1940. Copper pipes started being introduced to Troy in 1939. So these pre-1940s pipes are the ones that are being replaced by the city right now. And then after that, there's a few other ways that lead can get introduced that I didn't know about at all before this trip. One thing is lead can be introduced through lead solder, which was not banned until 1986. Solder is basically like the glue that's used to glue the joints of copper pipes together. Supposed to be like just a little bit of the solder around the joint where the copper pipes meet each other, but often it kind of leaks beyond the joint if someone like over applies it, which isn't uncommon apparently. And if it goes past the joint, then it comes in contact with water and lead can leach out at that point. And then the third way is through faucets and fixtures actually inside the house. And apparently these are better regulated than they used to be, but they can still lead to lead contamination. So we learned that prior to 1996, fixtures could have up to 12% lead in their composition. And this is weird because even if they look like stainless steel or nickel or copper on the outside, the interior pipes that move the water around inside are usually made of brass. And in older faucets, so like a few decades old at this point, up to 12% lead was being used in manufacturing brass. So when the water sits in that fixture overnight, and the brass parts that have lead in them, that can be a third source for lead contamination.
Okay. So does that mean that even if your lead service line is replaced, lead may still get into your drinking water?
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, the lead service line is the bulk of the contamination we're seeing, but also these lead-based solder joints or an older fixture can still contaminate drinking water. So the city's gradually taking care of replacing service lines, but interior plumbing, unfortunately, is the responsibility of individual property owners, be that a landlord or a homeowner.
How can concerned residents find out if their water is lead-free or not?
Well, hopefully, most of our listeners have seen that the city's working to get information about this out. I've gotten multiple mailers at my house over the past year. And if you haven't seen those, there's a lot of information online at troynewyork.gov/lead, or you can call the Department of Public Utilities at 518-237-0343. They should still be offering free water testing. Completely replacing lead pipes and fixtures is the best way to prevent lead exposure. But in the meantime, like in my case, I actually learned through this process while I was doing this work over the summer with Water Justice Lab that I have a lead service line through the testing. So I'm following city guidelines. They recommend running water for several minutes before use, especially if you haven't used it in a while, like overnight. We run our water 5 minutes first thing in the morning. Water for preparing food and drinks. Use cold water because it'll react less with the lead pipes, I guess. And then certainly use a water filter certified to remove lead for water used for drinking and cooking. I know they were giving out free filters for a while. I'm not sure the status of that. And there's lots of other resources and information about protecting yourself and your family from lead and drinking water. Our, you know, federal environmental regulatory agency, the Environmental Protection Agency, has tons of information on their website, and that's epa.gov/lead.
All right, excellent. You know, I live in a home that was built in the 1930s, so this is really great information for me to have, and I'll be following your practice of, you know, putting on the tap for 5+ minutes in the morning just to make sure that I'm safe. So thank you so much for that information. Ellie Irons, thank you for joining us. This is Emily Schussis reporting for Water Justice Lab.
Thanks to our 2023 Water Justice Lab fellows for that report. We are now accepting applications for 2024 Youth Water Justice Fellows. The Sanctuary seeks high school students to conduct water quality testing and produce media at Nature Lab, a community biology lab. Priority will be given to students residing in the city of Troy and attending Troy or Lansingburg High. Find more information at mediasanctuary.org.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Lennox Apurdo.
And I'm Bria Barthel. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
If you like what you hear, you can support this program by sharing our content with others. Find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org.
And now we turn to our weekly weather update and climate look with retired National Weather Service meteorologist Hugh Johnson. Welcome back, Hugh.
How you doing, Bria?
Doing good. How are you?
Good. What a beautiful Earth Day we had. Barely a cloud in the sky, deep blue sky. Quite a nice, refreshing change from the last few days where we were plagued with clouds, especially yesterday.
Yeah. So Earth Day is April 22nd each year and initiated in 1970 to focus attention on the planet's well-being. Can you tell us a little bit of history of the event?
Well, it actually happened, as you say, in 1970. Basically, we had a gentleman by the name of Gaylord Nelson. That was his brainchild, and he worked on it. And a lot of people came out into protest activists came out, like thousands, if not a million folks came out in that first year to really get it going. And it's like kind of ironic. It was under Richard Nixon, a Republican administration. He also founded the EPA. So, and my first Earth Day, I remember this, it was kind of funny. My science teacher gave us, told me an experiment to do. And remember those old vacuum cleaners, those old cylindrical Hoover vacuum cleaners that were really noisy? Well, anyways, I took one and I put a tissue paper on the end of the hose, and I was sucking towards the air into the house from outside. And I was amazed how much soot I got on that piece of tissue paper, the air quality. Now, I lived in Philadelphia. It was a nice day. I remember that first Earth Day was a nice day. It was a little warmer than today. It was near 70, but it was very sunny, and it was a nice day. But even on that nice day, I got a lot of soot on that piece of paper, which showed that the air had some issues. And, you know, it's funny because back in the day, in 1970, we had a lot more smog than we do now. So we had a lot more aerosols big aerosols, you know, from lead. We were still using lead in gasoline and lead in paint, as the last lecture talked about, the lead paint dilemma. That was still going on. But here's the problem. I mean, we have Earth Day. It's great. And I did some little cleanup. I try to do cleanups on Earth around Earth Day, you know, go out to the trails or whatever. But let's put something in perspective. In 1970, the atmosphere only had 310 ppm parts per million of CO2. And that was, you know, the first Earth Day. Now, 54 years later, or as we've discussed many times, our ppm is well over 400. So it's gone up over 25% or so. So even though the air has gotten cleaner, we're still putting CO2 in the air unchecked. And that's a problem.
Right. Hugh, so have you seen the climate change since 1970, and has Earth Day helped us advocate for environmental protections?
Yeah, definitely. There's been climate change. Absolutely. We've warmed the earth about a degree Celsius, almost 2 degrees Fahrenheit. Our winters are about 6 degrees warmer now than they were in 1970 in Albany. Our springs are about 2 degrees warmer. April, ironically, is probably the month that is warmed the least, less than a degree. And I think that in November, there are 2 months that for some reason haven't taken off on, but you know, every other month is warmed up several degrees, if not more. So yeah, huge. And of course, our precipitation has changed. We're much wetter than we were in 1970. We averaged like 3 or 4 inches more of rain than we did in 1970. Snowfall, a little less, but still not that much less, because we're getting more moisture kind of offsetting the temperature. So I'm sorry, what was the second part of your question?
Oh, I was asking whether they has helped us advocate for environmental protections.
I certainly try to, yes.
So we think of climate as mostly impacted by large entities like corporations. Governmental policies would seem to be most effective in combating this climate emergency. What are some important policies that have been implemented or that are currently pending to slow down climate change?
Well, we're still trying to, you know, become more green with the cars, you know, more electric vehicles, but there's still a lot of loopholes. I mean, we have electric vehicles. So I think it's like 10% on the road now. So that's a nice little increase, but you know, we still have a lot of problems with electric cars. The biggest problem is the charge, you know, how quickly you can charge a car. You cannot charge a car anywhere near as fast as you can fill up a tank of gas. And I'm not even talking about New Jersey, where it's about twice as long as New York, because you have to go, you know, they do it for you. But even there, if it's 5 or 10 minutes, that's still a lot faster than electric car to charge. We are trying to siphon some CO2 out of the atmosphere. There are machines, we talked about that too, that are actually siphoning some of the CO2 out, but that's a long way from being really effective. I mean, it's in the right direction, but very slowly. You know, basically, there's still a long way to go. We've talked about this. It's a long, long way to go, and we are warming more rapidly every year, it seems. We had the El Nino this year, which probably added a little bit on its own, and that's going away. So it'll be interesting to see next year. If we probably won't be quite as warm, because we'll flip to a La Nina, but we're still warming, as you well know, and probably not enough's being done. I mean, again, Earth Day is great, and we've really cleaned up again the air quality. We've cleaned up parks and things like that in some cases, but the bottom line is we're still in trouble.
Right, and speaking of policy, there's this kind of buzzword that's been used mostly by a lot of corporations recently, and that's the carbon offsets. And last year, between September 4th and 6th, actually, in there was the African Climate Summit, which took place in Kenya and was co-hosted by Kenya and the African Union. Yeah. And for a lot of young Kenyan climate activists, they were mentioning how concerned they were about the fact that instead of there being a more focus on other sustainable measures, most of the policy that was being pushed by, you know, corporations to African governments was them advocating for climate offsets. And so I'm just curious, do you think carbon offsets, do you think carbon offsets are going to be effective at helping us to correct climate change or mitigate
The jury's still out on that. And again, you know, we know what's happening this year. I'm not going to get into politics, but we have a major election coming, presidential election coming up, and we know which side stands for which. And neither side is doing enough to, in my humble opinion, to reverse the trend that we're seeing now. But certainly the other party would even be less of would be even less doing effective for that change. So I don't think they're doing enough. If that's what you're now. And Africa is probably the continent that's in most trouble because I've seen heat in Africa, in portions of Africa where temperatures have been so hot, it's almost unlivable. And people have died because of it. And, you know, of course, in Africa, you don't have as much air conditioning. You don't have the facilities that you have in other continents. So I think that's we're already seeing a lot of crop failure and things like that because of the incredible heat and drought and floods that are going on. By the way, just to throw this out, Dubai, the other in Arabia had a 6-inch rainstorm about 10 days ago, which is more rain than they have normally in a year. They got more rain in one day than they get in over a year. So we're seeing all kinds of, you know, this incredible intense and climate weather things going on that, again, one event doesn't qualify for a climate change, but we've seen so many of these events now. And Africa, like I said, is probably the continent that's most in trouble because of the intense heat and the, you know, the economy being not as strong as other, you know, other areas of the world. So that unfortunately, I'm not painting a good picture here, but that's the way I see it.
I want to switch back to local issues. You mentioned the dirty air earlier when you vacuumed with your cleaner, which I thought was really interesting. I've never tried that. And I just read an article in the Times Union about how we might have to deal with those Canadian wildfires again this summer, which will certainly polluted our air last summer. What do you think about that?
Well, there are still festering fires up in Canada, believe it or not. There's still like very, very low grade burning going on. And it was very dry.
They've been burning since last year?
Yeah, yes, in the ground, we call them peat fires, or they basically just smoldering. I guess smoldering is the better word to use. But the problem is it's been dry in Western Canada. We had a wet winter. We had a lot of rain and into March. March was very wet. And, February was dry. But, you know, up in Canada, it's been pretty dry, much, and they didn't have that much snow either. So, unfortunately, the antecedent conditions are favorable for possibly more fires to erupt as we get into the next month or so. We'll have to see how that goes, but no guarantee it's going to happen, but I guess the odds are a little better than more favorable that we will see more Canadian fires. And unfortunately, some of that smoke could very well get back down here. I hope not, but it is a possibility. And even if it's funny, because even if we have a wet summer, it could be dry in Canada and it won't matter because we're getting the smoke from there, even though we're not getting the actual fire, but the smoke and the air quality issues that we all dealt with last year was pretty awful.
It's been a fickle spring so far. It was pretty warm the week of the eclipse, but it seems to have cooled down a bit as we headed later into April with a whole bunch of more rain. Is it true that we have cooled down, and why do you think that is happening?
Well, we did cool down relative to climate. I mean, today actually turned out I got to 60, which is not far from from the normal high, but the lows have been a little bit colder. And again, we had a little piece of what's left of the polar vortex come on down and bringing a couple of chilly rounds of air. We're going to get another one later this week too. So tonight, I hope you didn't plan anything yet because we're going to get down to freezing tonight. We're still actually not quite at our basically our average for our last freeze, or even frost for that matter, or a last freeze is about a week from now on climatologically average. It's a few days earlier than what it used to be. We haven't changed as much in the spring as we have in the fall. We definitely extended in the fall. We now extend the season about a week to 10 days, but it's less than a week, I think, in the spring. And we still could get a frost. And by the way, you can get frost even with temperatures above freezing into the mid-30s, because the ground is colder than that. So you can definitely get frost, and that can still do damage. We can get that well into May, but even past Mother's Day for that matter. So we're not quite out of the woods yet with that. And we're gonna have a chilly night tonight, and we're gonna probably have a couple more at the end of the week.
So still too early to get the crops going, but what's the anticipated upcoming weather for the rest of this week?
Well, okay, so tomorrow will actually be the warmest day of this week coming up, at least the weekday of Monday through Friday. We'll pop into the 60s with a south wind, lots of sunshine, although we'll see clouds increase late in the day. And then we have a little bit of rain on Wednesday. It's not going to be a big deal, but it's still going to knock the temperatures down, be kind of another cloudy, kind of gloomy-ish day. And actually, we're going to get a front through, and there could be a few grapple showers floating around in the valleys, and maybe some wet snow showers in the higher terrain. I don't think any accumulations, but it could be kind of a chilly evening on Wednesday. And then Thursday and Friday, like I said, will be chilly, cold mornings, you know, in the 50s in the afternoon. But then on the weekend, it looks like we'll finally see a pattern change. We'll see a ridge building back in and a southerly flow that will take hold, and this time will stay. And we'll see temperatures not so warm on Saturday with a little bit of rain. But then on Sunday and Monday, we could soar into the 70s and even make a run at 80 degrees. You heard that right, 80 degrees. Yeah. So we finally get, we might get an 80 in here in April before April's over. So that'll be kind of nice.
Something else I heard was grapple showers. Can you briefly explain that? Briefly.
Soft tail. It's just basically precipitation is coming through the clouds. It's partially frozen, and it can get, because it's really cold aloft, it can actually be driven down to the ground with temperatures well above freezing. We won't be anywhere near freezing when this happens. It's soft hail, basically.
Thanks, Hugh, for joining us once again. We look forward to talking to you next week.
All right. Have a great one, folks. Happy Earth Day.
You too. Thanks.
You too.
Bye-bye.
And now we turn to hear about activities at the Troy Public Library for youth from tots through teens with Carol Roberts, Young People Services Librarian.
Hi. In a separate segment, Carol Roberts, Head of Young People Services at Troy Public Library, recommended a number of books for kids ages 2 and up. But now you can do something other than read with your kids. She's going to tell us about events for youth of different ages. So, Carol, welcome back to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Looks like you have a bunch of things on your April-May calendar, so start us off.
Well, every Monday night we have family game night, and that's from 5:30 to 7:30 in our young people's rooms, and people can play board games using ours, or they can even bring their own if they prefer. Also, upcoming, we're going to have a preschool music hour on Monday, May 6th at 3 p.m. at the main library with Lisa Russo, and it'll be a fun musical time. And this is for kids up to age 5 with a parent or caregiver.
And when you do concerts for young kids like that, it's always participatory, right?
Yes, she'll be bringing some fun instruments for the kids to use, and so hopefully it'll be fun for them.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. And next?
We have a teen game night, which is the first Tuesday of the month from 6 to 7 p.m. Our next one is going to be May 7th, and we play video games or board games, and there's snacks and other teens to hang out with, and this is for kids 13 to 18.
Do you get many kids coming to that? I'm sorry, do you get many teens coming to that?
We do. We usually have a good group, anywhere from, I would say, 5 to 8 teens that come.
Oh, that's terrific. And next?
Silly Science Night, my favorite. It's the second Wednesday of the month from 6 to 7, and this is also at Maine. And kids can learn the science behind what makes each activity work, and they get to bring home a fun DIY craft. And this is for kids ages 4 to 12. The next one will be May 8th.
And what will the craft be?
I don't know.
Oh, but it'll be silly.
No doubt. This is run by Sarah Bailey, who is one of our young people's librarians.
That's wonderful. Okay, and next.
Crafty Kids Night, which is the third Tuesday of the month from 6 to 7 p.m. Kids can create fun crafts based around a unique monthly theme. This is for ages 4 to 10. And I do want to mention that children under 8 must have a caregiver present at all times. And the next one is Tuesday, May 21st.
Sounds terrific. Anything else?
Teen Anime Club, fourth Wednesday of the month, 6 to 7 p.m. The next one is May 22nd, and kids, teens can come to Maine to watch a couple episodes of anime and sample Japanese candy. And again, this is for obviously for ages 13 through 18.
And it looks like you've got a few more.
Storytime Learn and Play, Thursday mornings from 10:30 to 11:15. We try to provide enrichment for children through stories, songs, movement, and play. And this is for ages 0 to 5 with a caregiver. And parents don't need to register. They can just come.
All right. And then?
We have Greta the Reading Dog. She's at Maine every Saturday from 11 until noon. And children can read to her or just visit. And all are welcome.
So say a little bit about the reading dog and how that works and why that works.
Well, she's a registered therapy dog, and she's great with kids. She loves children and loves being read to. And this offers an opportunity for children to practice reading aloud before someone who's very non-judgmental, and it helps build their confidence.
Oh, that sounds great. Okay. And it looks like the last one.
We have take and make kits, which are take home crafts for children and also for teens. And these are new every month, and you can pick them up either in the teen area or in the young people's room.
So if you like music, science, crafts, or dogs, games, this is the place to come. It's the Troy Public Library main branch at 102nd Street in Troy. I will advise you that the front looks like a giant plywood box, but the library is open while renovations are going on outside. And as Carol said, there are activities from tots to teens. Anything else you'd like to add, Carol?
I just want to emphasize you don't need a library card to enjoy our programs or any of the resources that we offer.
And are there any activities that you especially should register for in advance?
Not this month.
Okay, so if you want more details, the calendar is available online at thetroylibrary.org. That was Carol Roberts, Head of Young People Services, talking with me, Bria Barthel, for Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Carol, always a delight to talk with you.
Thanks so much for having me, Bria.
Thanks to Carol Roberts for sharing information on those activities. Later this week, we'll hear Carol's book recommendations for the month. For a separate segment on adult activities, see your website.
And now in our final segment, our roaming labor correspondent, Willie Terry, talks with Reverend Ibrahim Pedrinan about the positive and negative aspects of the labor movement in 2023 and his thoughts on what to look forward to in 2024. This segment is part two of three of that interview.
Now we go into 2024.
Sure.
Right. What are some of the top priorities for your organization or that you see that labor should be involved in this year?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, who's in office really does matter for workers. And so I think that, you know, workers have to be attentive to the political situation and the electoral situation. But I think more than that, I think that we have to ride those waves of victory. That when there is a culture of organizing, you start going out and you have those conversations and you try to identify kind of fertile ground for organizing industries. You start identifying that. So you start talking to workers and having those conversations about what does it mean for you to be in a union? What does it mean for you to have those rights and that voice? And I think that ultimately is always the work. That's going to be the work in 2024, in 2025, in 2026. I don't know that there's any specific work that labor has to do this year. I'm not huge on electoralism. Like, I don't think that that's where we have our power. I think our power comes from people and workers and solidarity. But I do think that we have to be attentive, especially in this rising wave of fascism. It's right. It's disgusting. It doesn't want anybody on the left. It doesn't want anybody who's got a union. It doesn't want anybody. It wants mindless drones, obedient servants. They would pay us nothing if they could. We would go back to, chattel slavery for everybody except for the billionaires. If they could have their way. And so the more that we get our power and we fight and we learn how to lobby and we learn how to, pass the PRO Act. But we have to, identify the goal.
But that was one of the issues that didn't happen.
Well, that's exactly right. So Right. The PRO Act, like with anything, you have to organize around it. The PRO Act is the Protect the Right to Organize Act. Right. And what that does is that really reinforces a lot of more. It's really on the side of workers, give them the right to organize, to not face captive audience meetings,
right.
Stringent standards for enforcement of labor law, repealing the Taft-Hartley would also be great, all of these sorts of kind of legislative aspects of things help out. But you don't get there by just talking a lot about it. You get there by having a plan, knowing your strategy, knowing your tactics, and keeping that as your singular focus. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there are so many things, like you said, that are going on in terms of the green economy, the cannabis economy. New York State's got this this whole problem with the tier system that's in the state system, that everyone's trying to fix. And so, how do you keep that pressure on? How do you move people to pass legislation? But I think the more basic power is always the more basic question is, how do you get power?
Yeah, I'm gonna come back and ask you just a few more questions, but
sure.
I want to get into some of the social questions.
Okay.
Right. And one, as we know, over the last year, there was America's is involved in another kind of skirmish or war, whatever.
Multiple wars, and, yeah.
Labor, it was one war, the war between Palestine and Israel. Mm-hmm. Labor didn't say anything for a while. Mm-hmm. And over the past few months, labor has came out calling for a ceasefire.
Correct, yeah. Wow.
And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, war is always a labor issue. And anybody who's paying attention knows that the labor temple, the labor headquarters that they had in Palestine was bombed in a specific Israeli airstrike in 2008. Labor was specifically under attack by Israel, Palestinian labor, and in terms of what our role is our role is not to ignore that, but to say, why do we think that Israel would specifically airstrike the labor headquarters? That's a first and foremost question, I think. And then kind of ask the implied questions thereafter. The labor movement is full of people of goodwill, is full of people who care about justice, is full of people who want to see a difference being made in the world. Obviously the situation that happened on October 7th wasn't the first situation, but it became a flashpoint. And the amount of retaliation, which workers know all about retaliation. Workers know all about collective punishment. We know all about how the boss is going to try to change the narrative. We know all about everything that workers who were paying attention saw happening in Gaza is the same thing that workers experience on the workroom floor. because of, again, power, the relationship there. And so I think there was a huge movement within the labor infrastructure to say, wow, this is ridiculous. This is what we face on a daily basis. Now they just have guns, you know, and bombs and military forces, but they're enforcing the same kind of rules that my boss would face against me. You know, it's really disappointing that the larger labor movement was so quiet for so long. Now, obviously, after time and organizing and protests and really going against, so the AFL-CIO has, kind of this, only the national AFL-CIO can talk about national or international things. And so there's this movement to sort of silence dissent or other opinions lower. Well, the AFL-CIO hadn't taken a stance, so any stance taken wasn't in conflict with the stance. It was just that the AFL-CIO hadn't taken a stance yet. And after pressure and workers building worker power, the AFL-CIO, I think, was forced to move. I don't think that was their choice. I don't think they were excited about it because of their connection with certain political infrastructure.
Yeah, there was the labor groups and also central labor councils across the country that was passed a resolution.
Absolutely.
Even though the AFL-CIO didn't give them authority, but they did it anyway.
They did it anyway, and that's what the labor movement is built on. They did it anyway, right? Like that phrase could talk all about, as a postal worker, the great postal strike in 1970, we just passed our 54th anniversary on that one, and they did it anyway. It was illegal. It was not legal to strike against the federal government, but these folks said enough is enough. We can't even survive anymore. We're living out of our cars. We're in bread lines. We qualify for welfare, and we're federal employees. And so when it came down to it, they said, we're going on strike. And they said, you can't go on strike. That's illegal. And they did it anyway.
To hear part one of this interview, visit our website. Part three will be in an upcoming episode. And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Lennox Aputo.
And I'm Bria Barthel. Our engineer is the wonderful Sina Bazili-Hickey. We appreciate you, Sina. And we thank all our volunteers who made today's episode possible. This is a team effort. Others helping with today's show include Mark Dunley, Muzami Moat, Emily Shusas, Willie Terry, and Hugh Johnson. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community, for the community, and is supported by independent donations. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer. Get more information at mediasanctuary.org.
We want to hear from you. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at Hudson Mohawk Mag, or send us an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Tune in weekdays at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news, or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Full episodes and individual stories are available on demand at our website on your favorite podcast platform.
And thanks to you, our listeners, especially that special live streamer in Kenya, for making this all worthwhile.